From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The ACLU Michigan is trying to stop the Trump administration from deporting 1,000 Iraqi immigrants, but being blocked by the courts.
People will die if this decision is allowed to stand.
Our political commentators say lame duck used to be useful.
I think lame duck session can be useful to get difficult things done.
But
it's now subject to a lot more abuses than in the past.
Lessons a term-limited legislator learned from Lansing.
When you act with civility, you can really tackle big issues facing our state.
And rolling back protections of U.S. waterways.
They, against all science, have decided we don't need to protect the tributary system. We don't need to protect adjacent wetlands.
All of that. Plus, we've got Christmas stories. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Around 100 Iraqi nationals were released this week after spending more than a year in ICE custody. But now they face more uncertainty after an appeals court struck down the ruling that ordered their release.
The majority said, even if people are facing death, if deported, a federal court is powerless to step in and stop it.
We'll hear what's at stake for these Iraqi nationals and their families later in the hour. But first, last night was an all-night session of the lame duck legislature. It sent a lot more bills to the governor, and here to talk about some of those are our Friday commentators. Gilda Jacobs is president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy and a former Democratic member of the Senate. And Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority in the Michigan Senate. A couple of our reporters were up all night keeping up with the action, so I'm guessing you two sat by your computers all night to catch it?
No, but I had a staffer doing it, so it was sending me notes all morning.
Are you crazy, Lester?
No, I slept. I just thinking, you know, you guys would be interested. All right, let's talk about what's going on. Gilda, I want to ask you, what bill in this lame duck session is one you've been watching closely?
Oh, boy. Well, two of the bills that we were watching very closely, the governor already signed. So those are the minimum wage and earned sick time. You know, obviously, we were concerned about the supplemental. There were some pretty decent things, quite honestly, that were in the supplemental. Although the Michigan enhancement grants, you know, we would kind of consider some pork bills that got passed.
Before we go too far, why don't you explain real briefly for those of us who don't know exactly what a supplemental is?
So a supplemental budget can be either a positive or a negative one. If there's extra money or not as much money at the end of the year, that can then be distributed kind of into different pots or different projects. So this time around, there was more money for some of the PFAS response. They increased the homeless shelter per diem, increased wages for direct care workers, which was really a big deal for the people that we advocate for. Some funding for the upcoming census, which is, again, super important in terms of how we get money back from the feds. But, you know, on the other hand, there was some shifting around of some funds that we were not happy about. You know, there's sort of a new pot of money through being able to tax internet sales in Michigan, and that money in part should be going to education, and some of that money got diverted into roads and less money into education. It's the kind of stuff that we really don't like seeing, because clearly you don't want to pit roads against education. It's the both and. You need to do both in our state if we really want to continue to move forward.
Ken, what have you been watching?
A couple of bills. One is a bill already on the governor's desk that would basically defer to federal rules, particularly when it comes to environmental protection. At least it would make it tougher for the state to adopt its own rules that are tougher than federal rules. And then the bill that died in the House, which would have taken the authority away from the Secretary of State when it comes to regulating campaign finance.
I want to ask you on that bill you're talking about, what they call the no stricter than federal. Is that something you want the governor to sign or veto?
I think you ought to veto it in a New York minute.
Yeah, and I agree with Ken on that as well.
The irony is it's a complete reversal of Republican philosophy that says states should have more authority to do what they want and not defer to the federal government. So I think it ought to be vetoed without much hesitation.
Gilda, what would you urge the governor to sign or veto?
Well, we're not happy with – there's a bill that would give lawmakers power over the attorney general – just from a Democratic standpoint, small d, we really feel this is really kind of anti-democratic. I mean, the people spoke and they, you know, elected the attorney general, and we kind of see this as kind of an overreach. So we would not like to see that passed. Some of the other bills that we're watching are not going to make it to the governor's desk. So, you know, so that's good. You know, at this point, when there are 400 bills that are going to the governor to sign, and there is really not a lot of time to wade through all of them to really see if they're going to be good or bad.
Yeah, I checked on that 400 number. It's actually a little less than it, about 280, but it's still a lot of bills.
It's still a lot.
You know, Lester, can I make a comment?
Sure.
Because I think one of the interesting things to me is that some of the really controversial bills or ideas never got to the governor's desk. They died. Mentioned that, you know, that would strip the Secretary of State's authority to regulate campaign finance, passed the Senate, died in the House. There was a bill that would allow a couple of departing senators to basically transfer some House Senate money to their old House campaign and then pay themselves back. And basically, it would benefit two senators. That passed the Senate, died in the House. There's a wetlands bill that was heavily amended. It originally would have exempted thousands of wetlands from environmental protection, and that exemption was actually stripped out of the bill. So there are some of the more controversial bills that really, to the legislature's credit, never got to the governor's desk.
I want to ask you about the process here, because, you know, one of the – I heard on the – well, gosh, I guess it was Shana Roth on Michigan Radio talking about this bill that basically came in one way, and then it was just chocked full of all kinds of pork to the point where the legislator felt like he had to make a statement that I won't even support my own bill as it's written now. Is that typical in lame duck?
Let's just say it's not unusual, you know, especially for people that – may not be coming back again. You know, they really want to see certain things go to their district, or, you know, feel like they've done things for their district on their retirement.
You know, Zach Gorchow with Gongwer News Service noted in a blog that he wrote that in the Senate, 37 of the 38 members, as a result of term limits, will never again face the voters for the seats they now hold. In the House, 67 of the 110 members will never again face the voters for the seats they now hold. So he concludes that with term limits, lame duck has the opportunity for large numbers of legislators with pet bills that they desperately want passed before they return to private life and have no worries about having to answer for those bills and votes by the voters. What do you think, considering that kind of controversy, is lame duck useful, or should the legislature consider ending lame duck sessions altogether? Gilda?
You know, it's interesting. Under Governor Snyder, budget bills were the budget was passed, you know, by the summertime. There are ways to get things done before lame duck if you really want to do them. You know, remember, we do have a year-round legislature, unlike many other states. You know, that being said, if bills are really good, they shouldn't be rushed through at the end. There really, as I said, there really is plenty of time to do this. You know, on the other hand, you know, Zach brings up really an important point, because even for the governor, as well as the sitting legislators, you know, at the end, you don't really have to listen to your caucus anymore. You can kind of listen to yourself and your heart, and, you know, perhaps have a little bit more spine in your voting than you may have had in years past on both sides, you know, of the aisle. So, you know, sometimes there's that kind of reckoning that people have, you know, at the end to maybe vote a little differently than they would have had when they were dependent to be strong members of their caucus.
Ken, are lame duck sessions really valuable or really hazardous?
Well, I think this lack of accountability argument is somewhat exaggerated, because although it's true, a lot of them are not facing an election in the near future. Their mindset is that they might run again for something. So I think it's just, you know, this sense that, well, they don't feel accountable, so it's Kelly bar the door in lame duck is a little exaggerated. I think lame duck session can be useful to get difficult things done, but I think what's happened in an era of term limits and where political DNA has just changed and become more polarized and more power oriented, it's now subject to a lot more abuses than in the past.
Yeah, and I would agree with Ken. And quite honestly, when you are pulling an all-nighter and you are working through 8 o'clock, you know, the next morning, you really don't even know what you're voting on at that, you know, at that point, because really everybody is pretty sleep deprived. So, you know, things get into bills that may not necessarily be all good, and then you got to go back and try to make corrections later on.
Yeah, well, there'll be none of that for this session of the legislature. They'll have to look to the next session to fix whatever they did wrong,
right.
I suppose. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Gilda Jacobs is a former Democratic legislator. Gilda, thanks so much for filling in for Vicki Barnett for the last
sure.
month. We've really appreciated having you here.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thanks, Lester.
Well, I wish Rusty would have played some like Charlie Brown Christmas music for me right there, because it would be a great transition, because we're talking about something that kind of looks like the Charlie Brown Christmas tree, but it's actually a weed. Wrapped in tinsel, surrounded by gifts, the sidewalk weed in Toledo has become a national story. So we sent Stateside's Joy Horan to the corner of Secor and Alexis to see what the buzz is all about. We'll hear first from Jimmy Isbinski, who has taken it upon himself to be the Santa of the Toledo Christmas weed.
Well, I work just down the street. I happen to be driving by, and I notice that somebody put a bulb on one of the weeds. I thought it was a great thing. And then as days progressed, I noticed that the more and more things were being put out here. And I realized that even an ugly weed in the middle of the road, given enough love and attention, can turn out to something beautiful. And that's what I think we all need this Christmas season. So that is the reason I came out. We have all kinds of toys. We have all kinds of decorations. We have everything from dog food to stuffed animals. There's a lady over here. She's handing out lottery tickets, giving the lottery tickets away. We have all kinds of really cool things. Trees, everything's out here. Scarves, hats, anything you could want for Christmas, we have out here.
My name is Linda Kinder. I'm from Holland, Ohio. I'm giving out scratch-offs, okay? This is a season to be giving, so that's what's in my heart today.
Think you have any winners in there?
Oh, yeah, there's winners. I don't know how much. Yeah, would you care for a scratch-off? Try your luck. You might as well.
For photos of the Toledo Christmas weed, just head to michiganradio.org. Coming up in 10 minutes, we say goodbye to the current Speaker of the House, Tom Leonard. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. There you go, Rusty. That's what we wanted. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Yesterday, the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals overturned a lower court's decisions regarding Iraqi nationals that the Trump administration wants to deport. Joining me now is Miriam Ackerman, senior staff attorney for ACLU Michigan, which has been working to stop these deportations. Does this mean these Iraqi immigrants will be deported now?
Well, I think certainly not right now, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One of them is that precisely because Judge Goldsmith entered the order that he did, many of these individuals have been able to, he gave them the opportunity to go to immigration court, and many of them are winning their cases in immigration court. They've filed the relevant motions, and so they're able to stay here because they had very strong immigration court cases. The second reason that's not going to happen immediately is that the Sixth Circuit order doesn't take effect immediately. And the third reason is that we learned that Iraq actually is opposed to involuntary repatriations, recognizes that these individuals face incredible danger if they're returned, and therefore has been unwilling to accept their forced removal.
So why did the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals overturn those decisions of a Detroit federal judge to require bond hearings and order a stop to the deportations?
Well, it's a 2-1 decision, and I obviously agree with the dissent here in finding that it's a very dangerous thing to say that courts are powerless to stop deportations, and that's really what's at stake here. The majority said even if people are facing death, if deported, a federal court is powerless to step in and stop that. It's a really alarming decision.
If a federal court is powerless, then who has the power? I mean, I thought the federal court was, you know, that's where you go when you've got an issue with the administration like this.
Well, that's precisely why this decision is so concerning. The idea that there cannot be judicial review is really alarming. So basically what happens here is that these individuals were ordered removed, many of them decades ago. In the meantime, the situation has become incredibly dangerous in Iraq. And so what happened last summer is that we were in a situation where individuals were facing imminent deportation to a country where they were likely to be tortured or killed if returned. And there was a Kafkaesque situation, says Judge White in her dissent, where they were going to be removed to a country where they could be tortured or killed before they had a chance to go to court to say, please don't remove me, I'm going to be tortured or killed. And the majority here said, we don't care. We don't care if people are going to get tortured or killed, that we are going to slam the courthouse door shut. It's an appalling decision. People will die if this decision is allowed to stand.
If these Iraqi immigrants knew they could be deported before ICE actually came and picked them up, why didn't they appeal their cases a long time ago?
Well, they had final orders, many of them decades ago, and the reality was that Iraq would not take them and that they had no reason to go into immigration court and seek reopening. The other thing is that the situation changes pretty rapidly in a foreign country, and so there's no reason to spend tens of thousands of dollars on immigration proceedings that are going to be useless. And therefore, people didn't go to court earlier for that very reason, because it would have been pointless. And so when they were suddenly rounded up, there was absolutely no way for them to get into immigration court fast enough. And so what happened is that Judge Goldsmith gave them time to have due process, gave them time to access the court system. And what this case shows so clearly is that due process matters and courts matter, because when these individuals had a chance to go to court, they were winning their cases. I was just contacted the other day by an attorney. He said to me, you know, my client's actually a U.S. citizen, and these are individuals who would have been deported, right? And so if you actually have a chance for due process, if you have a chance to go to court, you can show the danger that you're in, and you then have the opportunity to make your case. And we can see by the statistics in this case, it matters whether or not the courthouse door is shut or open. And sadly, the Sixth Circuit said that it doesn't matter, regardless of the consequences, regardless of the danger people face, they cannot go to court.
I want to clear up something about the Iraqi government's position. The Trump administration says Iraq will take these deportees back. You just told me that Iraq won't take involuntary deportees. I mean, there are two things being said there that kind of conflict. Can you help us understand that?
Sure. So when we started this case, we believed, because the government said, that that Iraq was going to take all of these individuals back, and that as a result of a deal that had been made with Iraq, Iraq was going to change its longstanding policy and accept the repatriations. That, in fact, turned out not to be true. In fact, in his November decision, Judge Goldsmith said that the government had submitted demonstrably false evidence to the court about that alleged U.S.-Iraq agreement. In fact, once we got the documents, it turned out that Iraq really is opposed to involuntary repatriations. Now, that said, the U.S. government is expending tremendous foreign policy capital on trying to pressure Iraq to take people back. And so we don't know what Iraq will do in the future. It's possible that Iraq will bow down to U.S. pressure. It's really appalling when you think about it that given all of the foreign policy issues in the region, what the State Department is prioritizing apparently is removing people, pressuring Iraq to change its policy so that people can be removed, who the U.S. government itself acknowledges face tremendous danger because of their ethnicity, because of their religion, because of the very fact that they are westernized and Americanized and are Americans in everything but a piece of paper. And that's what we're using our State Department for, is to pressure Iraq to take back people Iraq doesn't want to take, because Iraq knows they will be in danger.
So what's next? What options are available to you to prevent these 1,000 Iraqi immigrants from being deported?
Well, certainly we are looking at all of our appellate options. The stakes here are tremendously, tremendously high. They could not be higher when you're talking about deportations to a country that's so dangerous. And there will certainly be further legal proceedings. I can't comment on what those will be, but there will certainly be further legal proceedings in this case. And then, of course, individuals have an opportunity now to go to immigration court. They've had that opportunity, and they are winning their cases in immigration court. So that's where ultimately these cases need to be won. The question before the Court of Appeals was, do we actually give people time to do that? And the people who've had that time, they've proven that that time matters, and that courts matter, and that due process matters.
Miriam Ackerman is Senior Staff Attorney for ACLU Michigan. Thanks very much for explaining this to us.
Happy to be here.
I don't know if you know this, but about 60% of the members of the Michigan House are term limited out of office. Our next guest is also leaving. He is Speaker of the House, Tom Leonard. Well, first of all, how are you feeling about the all-night marathon of the lame duck session?
I'll tell you, I'm glad to be done. It's been a long 4 weeks. We were able to get a lot done the last night. It was, as you just mentioned, it was long, but ready to be done. I think I got about a 90-minute nap, and now we're ready to go through for the rest of the day.
I want to ask you, what do you think are the highlights of the lame duck session?
Well, you know, I look at probably first and foremost what we were able to do with the tunnel with Line 5. This, in my opinion, was a great compromise. I mean, as we all know, we've got to protect our Great Lakes. But I felt that we needed to do so in a way that was also going to ensure that tens of thousands of residents in the Upper Peninsula would still be able to heat their homes. So I was glad to get that done a couple weeks ago with this new tunnel that's going to be fully funded by Enbridge. Glad to see that we are going to not only protect our Great Lakes, but ensure that those tens of thousands of residents in the Upper Peninsula that depend on that line for heat for their homes are going to continue to be able to do so.
Well, what we really wanted to talk to you is basically kind of do an exit interview. When you first ran for representative, what were your top priorities 6 years ago?
Oh, goodness. So, you know, I came in about 2 years into the Snyder administration. And, you know, they were still in the process of, if you want to call it, reinventing Michigan. And, you know, my goal was to make certain that we pushed good, sound policy that was going to continue to improve the lives of the people of our state, improve the economy, create a better work and jobs environment. And I believe we've done that over the past 6 years.
I was going to say, how many of the things that were your top priorities, maybe your top three, that you were able to actually accomplish during your 6 years in the House?
Yeah, you know, it was very interesting. I mean, for instance, my first term, as you know, I was a prosecutor in Genesee County for 3 years. And one of my big things that I wanted to get accomplished was some criminal justice reform, or some reform that happens at the first step of the process of the criminal justice system. And it was called preliminary exam reform. And this was something that the state had worked for two or three decades to try to fix. It was our system was so messed up. It was costing taxpayers probably millions of dollars a year. The process was re-victimizing victims every week. I saw that as a prosecutor in Genesee County. And when I came in, that was my big thing. I wanted to fix that process. And it was funny, Lester, everybody said, good luck. It's simply not going to happen. We just can't get it done. We've spent a couple decades trying to do that. And I started to work on this, and I found out within a few weeks that the reason we were never able to get anything accomplished was because nobody ever put the District Court Judges Association and the Prosecuting Attorneys Association in the same room and had them actually talk about the issue. And they got in a room for a few days, talked about the issue. They emerged with a compromise. It was something much different than where I was headed, but we were able to get that done. And not only get it done, we got it done unanimously in the House of Representatives and with only one no vote in the Senate. And what I learned real quickly is that when you just sit down, when you talk about issues, when you treat people with dignity and respect, when you act with civility, you can really tackle big issues facing our state.
Now, you've got 6 years. I mean, you're term limited. I'm wondering what are some of the things you wish you could have done but just ran out of time?
You know, probably the biggest one that eluded me, and it's eluded so many people before me, but, you know, sadly, it's eluded the people of this state, has been auto insurance reform. We've got the highest auto insurance rates in the nation. And if right now, if I could wave a magic wand and lower everybody's auto insurance rates 20%, we'd still have the highest auto insurance rates in the nation. So as we look to this next, this 100th legislature, this is going to be a big deal for them to continue to try to tackle. And that's something I wish we'd have gotten done. I wish we'd have gotten it over the finish line. Unfortunately, we didn't. And hopefully they can get that accomplished in the next couple of years.
Several years ago, former Speaker Rick Johnson was talking with some of his reporters, and he said term limits were a problem, that he really should have known a lot more before becoming Speaker of the House. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about term limits and the limited experience a legislator has before being in leadership?
Yeah, I mean, it does make it very, very difficult. And, you know, not just with becoming Speaker, but also having to work with new members. When I first came in, I believe we had 47 new members in the House of Representatives. So, for instance, I've mentioned this auto insurance issue. It's a very difficult, complex issue, and something that usually, you know, it takes many members months to really grasp and understand. So when you've got a turnaround of 40 to 50 new members coming through every 2 years, it does make tackling these big issues very difficult. So, you know, many have asked what my thoughts are on term limits. I'm one that actually I do support term limits, but I do think that we could amend them. I think we could look at changing them. For instance, maybe we could look at giving, you know, right now you can serve 6 years in the House and 8 years in the Senate. Maybe we could look at just giving a legislator 12 or 14 years to serve however they want, and then you'd stop all this jockeying back and forth between the Senate and the House. You'd get members that could just stay in the House for more than 6 years and really understand these issues, really grasp them, and you know, get some things done.
I understand your position on term limits. I'm reminded, though, of a guy who used to tell me, you know, if you can't learn a job in 2 years, you don't belong in that job. And I'm thinking, it's a $56 billion corporation you're trying to run by committee.
Well, and it's not just understanding the job. I mean, anybody will tell you when you come in, the only way you are going to be successful, you know, you can't be a jack of all trades. You've got to find a couple issues and you've got to master those issues. But to grab a couple issues like auto insurance reform or energy or health policy, sometimes it's very difficult to become the go-to person and master those issues in just 18 months or 2 years. So, you know, it's not a matter of learning the job. It's not a matter of, you know, learning where the office is or how to reach out to constituents, but finding some of these big issues, mastering them, but probably most importantly, building those relationships and building trust. That's the big thing where I think term limits have really caused a problem, is that you just simply don't have enough time in the House to build that level of trust with individuals to tackle some of these big issues that need to be tackled.
You not only worked as Speaker this year, but you had a tough primary opponent, a general election opponent, in your run for Attorney General. With that option now taken off the table, what's next for you?
Well, it's interesting. This was asked last night by the media, and I was very clear. You know, I have personally felt while there's outstanding legislation and things have been pending, I felt it would be inappropriate for me to sit down and have serious discussions with anybody about a job. And I was very clear that we were going to wait until we adjourn, which we've done that now. So I tell you, what I'm most looking forward to right now is being a much better dad and being a much better husband. As you mentioned, I've not only been Speaker, but I've been in a statewide race for Attorney General. I've been on the road a lot. And my poor wife, my daughter, they sacrificed a lot having me gone. So I am really looking forward to spending time with them over the holidays. And then shortly after Christmas or the new year, I'll start to have those conversations. And, you know, I look forward to doing something that I'm passionate about, that, you know, I just get up every day enjoying.
Well, ideally, what is that? What are you passionate about?
You know, I love this political process. I love strategy. I love tackling big policy issues. So if there's a way for me to stay involved, and it doesn't necessarily have to be politically, it doesn't have to be with public service, which, you know, certainly I would enjoy, you know, continuing to do that. I just want to be somebody that's there to tackle big issues facing the citizens of the state of Michigan. I love this state. I have no interest in going anywhere else. I want to be here for the rest of my life, and certainly I'd love to find something that I'm passionate about where I could go out and continue to tackle big issues for the citizens of the state of Michigan.
Well, best of luck in the future.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and certainly if you ever have any other questions or anything, reach out anytime. I'd love to come back on the show.
Tom Leonard is the Speaker of the Michigan House of Representatives. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Up next, the Trump administration wants to change the Clean Water Act by weakening protections for tributaries and wetlands.
You don't protect the tributaries, you don't protect the rivers and streams. You take away the protection of the wetlands, you've taken away the filtering system that protects our rivers and streams.
What those changes would mean for our water. Next on Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Trump administration has proposed changing the Clean Water Act. Farmers and developers like these changes. Environmentalists, hunters, anglers, and people concerned about drinking water, not so much. Joining me now is David Ullman. He was chief of the Environmental Crimes Section at the Justice Department during both Democratic and Republican administrations. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Lester. Happy to be here.
You wrote an op-ed for the New York Times that was titled, Trump wants to weaken clean water rules. In what way?
President Trump's EPA has proposed that we limit protections to the tributary system, which feeds into rivers and streams across America. They also want to weaken the protection for wetlands, which are the areas that are immediately adjacent to rivers and streams. The reality of clean water, of protecting water quality in America's rivers and streams, is that if you don't protect the tributary system, what goes into the tributary system flows downstream and ends up in our rivers and streams. So you don't protect the tributaries, you don't protect the rivers and streams. You take away the protection of the wetlands, you've taken away the filtering system that protects our rivers and streams. So you can't have one without the other. And they, against all science, have decided we don't need to protect the tributary system. We don't need to protect adjacent wetlands the way we have been for 40 years.
Now, I talked to the Farm Bureau last week, and they indicated, look, this was government overreach. We're glad that this is going to actually set things more clearly so we're not accidentally in violation, because it's a criminal violation if you're in violation of the Clean Water Act, they said. And you understand that they want some certainty. They also say that, you know, every little mud hole or every little depression that sometimes gets wet means I can't farm it. I can't do that. Developers are worried about putting something together and then finding out, oh, gosh, that house just put me in violation and now I'm in trouble. So was it government overreach, in your opinion?
Hard to see how we have government overreach when this is what we've been doing since the 1970s. Since the 1970s, we've had a national commitment to the idea that we want our rivers and streams to be fishable and swimmable. We want clean drinking water for our communities. I mean, this is kind of a basic idea, isn't it? We've provided full protection to tributaries. We've also provided full protection to wetlands. Taken together, what that's meant is that we've cleaned up America's rivers and streams. America's rivers and streams aren't on fire anymore the way the Cuyahoga River was, the way the Detroit River was. The idea that somehow it's government overreach just is completely wrongheaded. We can talk about farmers and we can talk about developers and whether there's ways these rules should be limited, and that's a good conversation to have. But this idea that it's government overreach or the idea that people are going to go to jail if they're just trying to farm their land, that's crazy talk. And that shouldn't be part of the conversation.
Well, at the core of that whole argument is, I've got private property rights. Why is the government infringing on my private property rights?
Right. So this is where, you know, I think a lot of the controversy comes because we get the tributary system and wetlands mixed up together. Part of the problem there is the Clean Water Act, because the Clean Water Act doesn't make a distinction between them. And the Clean Water Act doesn't make a distinction between them because nature doesn't either. You know, nature cares about...
Yeah, it's all connected.
It's all connected. Exactly. What flows downstream is what nature cares about. You can't have clean water in America if you don't protect the tributary system that feeds our rivers and streams. So let's take that and let's push that off to the side. Although, to be clear here, the Trump administration wants to roll back those protections. And I can't think of a single good reason why you would do that. I think where the controversy comes in is when we talk about wetlands. Because wetlands oftentimes, I mean, are in the eye of the beholder. I mean, to some people who, you know, you mentioned conservation groups, fishermen, people who like to watch birds. You know, wetlands are great because they're habitat for a whole host of species. They're really important. They're kind of like a filtration system. I said in the New York Times piece you talked about, they're kind of like a strainer in a sink. They keep a lot of bad stuff out of the rivers and streams that they're next to. But to a lot of other people, wetlands are, you know, swampland, you know, mosquito infested. So we get into this kind of battle. And, you know, I think we need to protect wetlands. I don't think there's any question we need to protect wetlands. They're an essential part of the ecosystem. They're part of how we have clean water in America. But we need to protect wetlands in a way that, you know, respects the role of farmers in our communities and respects the private property rights that you're talking about.
So there was a rule in 2015 under the Obama administration, and it kind of struck a balance, the kind of balance you're talking about. Not everybody was perfectly happy with it, and there's some court cases against it, as your piece outlined. But it looked like, hey, we're about to make this all settled law. And now the Trump administration is saying, no, we're going to get rid of that. Well, you can't get in the way of enterprise. You got to make sure that things are ready. So where's the balance? Is it the Trump balance? Is it the Obama balance? I mean, where is the balance?
We came together in the 1970s around this idea that we wanted our rivers and streams to be fishable and swimmable. We wanted to be sure that our rivers and streams could provide drinking water for communities across America. And the balance we struck then was we'd protect the entire tributary system. All rivers and streams in America get protection if they're connected to our bigger rivers and streams. We also struck the balance then that we would protect all adjacent wetlands, meaning all wetlands next to those rivers and streams, because of this kind of strainer effect that keeps pollution out of rivers and streams. I frankly think that was a pretty good balance to strike because it basically said fishable and swimmable rivers and streams, healthy rivers and streams, and rivers and streams that could provide drinking water for America. I mean, I think that was probably the right balance, but there's been pushback over the years. And the pushback comes, I think, in part because, you know, what does it mean to be for a wetland? When are the wetlands to be protected? Is it when they're right next to the rivers and streams? Is it when they're 40 miles away? That became this big controversy. Sometimes they were 40 miles away, and a lot of people got pretty hot about that. So the Obama rule comes along, and what they say is, all right, we're going to impose some distance limits. And, you know, distance limits are kind of tricky. There's, like, no science behind distance limits. And so the environmental groups got real hot, and they said, hey, where's the basis for these distance limits? And meanwhile, the people, particularly in the development community, said, shouldn't be any distance. You shouldn't bother with wetlands. They're swampland. I kind of think the Obama folks, you know, they were getting it from both sides. That says to me maybe they got the balance right, and Trump wants to blow the whole thing up. There's a big surprise.
I want to talk about what you've been saying along. You know, the whole idea of the Clean Water Act is basically make it safe to drink the water, safe to eat the fish in the water, safe to swim in the water. The problem is, even with all the advances we've made since the 1970s, we've got PFAS contamination that's making the water undrinkable in this state. We've got fish that are contaminated by PCBs, by PFAS, by some other chemicals, to the point where we're advised to limit or not eat fish of a certain size. It's not a good idea to go swimming in some places because if you ingest PFAS foam, that's not good. So why are we weakening protections or thinking about weakening protections when we haven't even hit the goal of the Clean Water Act?
Right. I mean, you've just hit the nail on the head. I mean, we've had 40 years of, I would say, pretty good progress The Trump administration wants to pull back on that. They think we went too far. But how could we have gone too far when we still have the kind of problems you've described in rivers and streams across America? How have we gone too far when we've got PFAS contamination now posing a serious threat to drinking water across the country? We actually need to be doing more, not less, to protect America's rivers and streams. We need to be doing more, not less, to protect American communities and to make sure they get safe drinking water. And we don't have to, you know, we don't have to look far in this state to see what happens when we don't do enough. You know, we've got to do better. And so it's stunning to be at a time where we're actually talking about, we're actually having a conversation about whether we should do less, because we need to be doing more.
So this proposal to change the Clean Water Act is a proposal. Who gets to decide whether it becomes rule?
Another great question. So yes, the proposal is out there for what's called public comment. It's kind of a cool thing in this country. One of the things we do whenever the government wants to make a new rule, we put the idea out there and we say, you know, let us know what you think. But on this one, we pretty much know what the Trump administration thinks. And, you know, they're going to hear from people telling them this is a great idea. They're going to hear from people telling them it's a terrible idea. In the end, they're going to do what they set out to do in the proposed rule, which is they're going to roll back the Clean Water Act protections. They're going to limit the protections to tributaries. They're going to limit the protections for wetlands. And then it's all going to end up in court, because the environmental groups are going to challenge them. A lot of states, hopefully our own, you know, we've got a change of administration coming and a new attorney general coming in, and hopefully she's going to stand up for our environment. And hopefully she'll join the environmental groups in challenging this rule, particularly if state law becomes no more protective than federal law. We're going to need to challenge this rule. So it ultimately will be up to the courts whether the rule stands. And the fact that the rule, as currently formulated, ignores basic science means there's a pretty good chance the courts aren't going to accept it, in which case we'll be back to the 2015 Obama-era rule.
Which is imperfect.
Which is imperfect, but is a whole lot better for communities across America than what this administration is proposing.
David Ullman was chief of the Environmental Crime Section at the Justice Department and currently is a law professor at the University of Michigan. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Christmas can be a special time of year for a lot of different reasons. However, for stateside producer Mike Blank's family, Christmas 2018 stands out. He's here in the studio with me, so what makes this year's Christmas more special than normal?
Okay, this year marks the 50th consecutive year my dad composing an original Christmas carol. And just to give you a little background on this, my dad's a retired Episcopal priest, but almost equal parts jazz musician, okay? And so when I was growing up, every year on the back of our Christmas card or Christmas letter we'd send out, our family Christmas letter, there'd be this Xerox sheet music on there of my dad's new Christmas carol for that year. And I just didn't really think of anything of it as a kid. And now as I've grown older, I just realize what a huge feat that is to do 50 years of an original composition. And so I sat down and talked
to him. You've almost got a hymn book full of Christmas songs.
Yes. Yeah, he literally does have a book full of them. And so I sat down and talked to him. We talked for a long time, so I narrowed down our conversation. And some of the music you'll hear in the background of this are my dad's original compositions. You'll hear Mary Bore a Baby, The World Stands Still on Christmas, and The Christmas Blessing. So here's the conversation with my father, the Reverend Richard L. Blank, talking about composing an original Christmas carol for 50 consecutive years. So 50 years is a long time. Where do you get your inspiration?
Well, some things always come. Sometimes it starts with the lyrics, sometimes going over the Christmas stories and picking up some line, some phrase, some thought from that. Sometimes I start with the music and then find that lyrics come later. So it's happened many different ways that I've gotten these carols.
So of the 50 carols that you've written, that you've composed, are there a few that are your favorite that stand out to you?
There are. My one friend, who's a, he and his wife are music directors, and about 15 years ago, I wrote one called Where Are the Shepherds Going Tonight? And they so liked that that they've sung it every year since. The choir has demanded it.
Well, that kind of leads me to the next question. What happens to these songs? Are they performed? Like, what ends up with the final product?
Well, let's see. I did record some of them, and they've gone to some different pastor friends that have used the music, choir directors that I knew, that type of thing. Community Church, Evangelical Presbyterian Church in Owosso, that's one church. They've used quite a few of my Christmas carols and a good number of other songs also. I've gotten small royalties from some of the Christmas carols. And then there were some really nice Christmas books put out by the Lutheran Church, Christmas books that included some of my carols.
Now, going back to the songs that you liked, you mentioned the one. Is it other ones that you liked a lot, or you just always like, wow, that one really stands out to me?
There are some others that I thought went quite well.
Well, you got to tell me what they are.
Oh, let me think. Christmas Is in My Heart, that was a very lively piece, and The Shepherds Danced was another carol title. The World Stands Still on Christmas Eve. So those are some of my favorites.
The world stands still on Christmas Eve. A holy silence falls on those who worship Jesus Christ.
All right, and so what's this year's carol?
This year's carol is Christmas Is Jesus Alone.
Do you mind going over to the little keyboard and playing us a little bit?
And I'll take the second ending on this.
Piano is not your main, or keyboard is not your main instrument.
No.
So what's your main instrument?
My main instrument is the alto sax, which I've played since about age eight. Then the other instrument that I picked up is vibraharp.
And tell me the story of how you ended up with vibraharp.
Well, when I was in seminary in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I had friends over in Boston at the Berklee School of Jazz, and one of them was Gary Burton, the world-famous vibraphonist, vibraharpist. He was given a new set of vibes each year if they could use his name for advertising, and he sold me his set very inexpensively. I always thought it'd be fun to play vibes, and that opportunity opened up, and I've enjoyed playing vibes.
Have you collected a book of all 50 in a row?
Yes, I have a book that has all the Christmas carols.
Do you think I'll get much money from Antiques Roadshow when I'm old and I take it? Do you think I'll get money for it?
Be a surprise to me.
I guess I just want to say, as a son to a father, thank you for sharing this gift and your love of music with me throughout my life, and it led me to creating and doing stuff musically on my own as well. So I just want to say thank you, Dad. I love you.
Love you. Thank you, Michael.
Merry Christmas. May God shower you with grace. Merry Christmas. May you dwell in His embrace. Merry Christmas. May He fill your heart with song. Merry Christmas. May God bless you all year long.
From all of us here at the Stateside team, enjoy the holidays, have a happy new year. We'll be back in 2019. I'm Lester Graham, and as always, thanks for listening.